Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul. BlakeRadio.com.
Welcome to Topically Yours on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul.
And as always, I'm your host, Deirdre Shulman. You know, I've been thinking today that sometimes people are faced with challenges in life. You know I am. Challenges that may be viewed as a burden, but prove to be the very thing that helps to define character and help us realize how truly strong we really are. You know, Ray Charles had the challenge of blindness. But from what I hear, he used other senses that served him just as well as if he had sight. Gloria Lynn told me that he even piloted a plane. And Cynthia Scott recounted how Ray was capable of hearing a single false note and could spot the very band member who made that wrong note because he had exceptional hearing. And this is what made Ray Charles Robinson an exceptional musician. I'm told that Mr. Charles could be a taskmaster, but only because he expected others to demand the best of themselves as well. Today, I'm very privileged to have as my guest Ray Charles Robinson, Jr., Ray Charles's oldest son. Mr. Robinson has authored a book entitled You Don't Know Me, which is a reflection of my father, Ray Charles. Mr. Robinson is a film producer in his own right and co-produced Ray Charles' 50 Years in Music. He also co-produced a DVD entitled Christmas Jubilee, Ray Charles with the Voices of Jubilation. Co-produced the independent film Hotel California, and is the winner of the 2011 NAACP Image Award for an outstanding literary work on this particular book we're talking about, You Don't Know Me, Reflections of My Father, Ray Charles. And also, he is the founder of the Ray Charles Jr. Foundation for America. Well, you may have heard him giggle a little bit in the background, so you know he's here with us. And I'm delighted to welcome him to the show. How are you, Mr. Robinson?
Pleasure to be you.
Well, I'm glad to have you, and I know that you're about to take off for the month of May to China. Why don't you tell me a little bit about what you're going to be doing there?
Well, this is a result of the book. I was invited to the Kodak Theater in Rochester, New York, as a guest and to read before the audience, before the Philharmonic, and before the Seasons of the Pops started. So basically, this was the opening season of the Pops at the Rochester, with the Rochester Philharmonic. And it was a great experience. It was the 88th anniversary of the Kodak Theater. And there I read before the audience excerpts from my book. Well, once I did that, I met a woman from China. And she was a very well-known writer. And she asked, would I be interested in going to China as a cultural exchange, to share my views and to talk about my culture, as well as being a successful independent producer, as well as an author.
Now, when she wants you to talk about your culture, is that American culture or African American culture?
Well, I plan to talk about African American culture within America. I want to dispel that that view of us as being lazy. I want to talk about our intellectuals, you know, our struggles, you know, for equality, and talk about noteworthy African Americans and how we have contributed to this American culture, you know.
Well, you know, that's kind of interesting that you say that, because just this morning I was telling people about how African Americans are viewed perhaps around the world as being lazy, but that we had businesses. It wasn't that we didn't form businesses, but I mentioned in Rosewood, one of the towns that got burned down that were filled with African American businesses.
That's correct.
And oftentimes we were discouraged from even reading, let alone having a business.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to talk about across culture. I'm going to talk, you know, my lecture is about the global influence of music, poetry, and film, and how that has influenced a world culture globally. But also what I'm writing about are, you know, our contributions from Ray, which I co-produced as well, that award-winning film. You know, my book, which depicts my relationship with my father, who is iconic, who has contributed greatly. His imprint is left indelibly in this fabric of America. But also I want to talk about Alexander Pushkin, who was Russian, who was of African-American descent. I want to talk about the Harlem Renaissance, which was not only a spiritual awakening, but a cultural awakening for the African-American, what we contributed, how that was so influential to so many writers, playwrights, and what our voice was for that. And in discussing the Booker T. Washington's and W.E.B. Du Bois, Langston.
Well, Connie Cullen came out of that.
Connie Cullen, Elaine Locke. I want to talk about our intellectuals. I want to talk about that. I want to approach it, and not from this age where you have entertainment, where you have athletes and stuff. I'm talking about intellectuals who are extremely educated, who were very influential in the first half of the 20th century and leaders in the 19th century. So I want to talk about that, and I want them to, and then, and only then, will they do their own discovery about us, African Americans, and our culture. And I feel that is vital.
Well, we also attributed to the first heart surgery and so many other things.
Well, you know,
that
you
don't hear about. We designed Washington D.C.
In their society, I hope that they will delve into learning about poetry, James, you know, James Baldwin, his struggles, you know, his struggles, you know, first of all, being simply a American treasure as far as an author, because he was so vocal about cultural equality for the black man, African American man, but he was also homosexual. And in the 60s, that was just not something that you spoke about, and he wrote about that in his writings. And so, controversial, true. Did he love this country? Yes. But did he die on this soil? No, he died in France, and where he can be accepted as a human being. And literally, that's all it's really been about. It's about being accepted as a first-class citizen.
Like Paul Robeson.
Yeah, well, Paul Robeson is on that list too. You have James Robinson.
Certainly,
you know,
he was
you have James Robinson.
A lawyer.
The story
people
about
don't even
James
know
Robinson,
that.
Who went to Russia in the early 20th century as a consultant for Ford Corporation, who was not allowed to leave Russia, and we talk about that. And there are a lot of great things to talk about in which our culture and how we've contributed to this country, not only through the wars, but intellectually and culturally.
Well, getting back to your father, in a way, he grew up, he was born in 1930?
Yes, that's correct.
How was that for him? As most black people know how it was, and maybe to some degree still is, but back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and up until the 60s, very difficult, especially in the South, for black people. How did your father fare back then in the 40s and 50s and so forth?
Well, I mean, you can understand, not only was he fighting, racism at that time, and separatism, segregation, but Jim Crow, as far as being a musician and performing in those states and what he had to succumb to. Ironically, my father was blind, so I can't even imagine, how he felt, there was one story about he and David Fathead Newman were basically stopped for speeding. The police stopped them on a road and told them, using the N-word, and they basically got out of the car. My father was left in the middle of a road, a country road, by himself because he was not able to get back in the car. They took the keys, and he had to find his way home. That was the racism that he experienced. Not only that, but also.
And they did that deliberately?
It was deliberate in the fact that they knew he was blind, and they took the keys. And so I think, the listeners can read between the lines on that one. But on the same token, I want to talk about the influence of music and what he did for this country, and while doing that, some of the struggles that he had made, but also the positive effect that his music had on African Americans, simply because his music was universal, it gave hope, and there was pride in that music, him being so successful during that period of time, unlike a lot of different musicians. I talk about in this lecture, in reference to music, I talk about the origins of rock and roll. And I truly don't believe that a lot of individuals who listen to music really don't understand the foundation of rock and rock and roll, which was laid by Chuck Berry, Sun Records,
and others.
Sam Phillips, you had Ray Charles, you had B.B. King. Muddy Waters really truly was the foundation of rock and roll. Chuck Berry, I feel, basically fathered rock and roll. Then came Little Richard. Then came Elvis Presley, who was with Sun Records. But Elvis Presley was riding on the shoulders of Muddy Waters, Ray Charles, and Chuck Berry, and all these others who had been recorded, okay?
I don't know if Elvis ever admitted to that, but he knows that he studied black performers in order to even get his style, and the Beatles did come out and admit that.
Well,
they attributed all their style to black people.
There are a lot of others who talk about, but unbeknownst, it was our jazz music, and this goes back to ragtime in the 20s. Jazz, our creation of jazz
was by New Orleans
musicians.
A black person
the Creole culture. And it goes through that foundation and how we basically influenced. Rock and roll was an evolution of blues. Jimi Hendrix was the perfect bridge because he was a blues player, influenced by B.B. King, Albert King, Muddy Waters, and these other guitar players, Wes Montgomery. Here's a guy who was probably the greatest guitarist of all time in rock music. His music still stands the test of time. But here's a guy that crossed the bridge of rock and roll, and truly, truly, you knew his foundation was from the blues. And so I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the origin and evolution of music and how rock and roll became so influenced. And then from Jimi Hendrix's influence, you had Eric Clapton with Cream. You had Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin. I mean, these guys still can't come close to playing like Jimi Hendrix, but they studied him. And was he the greatest influence on rock? Yes. And
Jimi Hendrix, unfortunately, wasn't even that well received in the black community, not originally anyway.
That was one of his struggles. And he struggled greatly with that because of his style of playing. He just truly wasn't accepted. But I have to tell you, I am a true Jimi Hendrix fan, and his music, if you go back and listen to him, he just, was born in the wrong time, I guess,
I was about to say that because I think people now, on second sight, think of him as a genius.
well, he was a genius, and nobody really ever will be able to play like him, especially with him experimenting with stereophonic, a stereo before it really became prominent, because he used that to switch. If you go back and listen to Electric Ladyland, you'll listen to how he moved the wah-wah from one speaker, the wah-wah of the guitar back and forth from one speaker to another, which was simply fantastic and unheard of at that time. And so it is my duty as a cultural exchange to continue to pass the word about our contributions to this American culture. Okay.
Oh, I'm proud of you for doing it. That's great.
Yeah, I want them to understand.
We need more
citizens
going across the world.
And we're not second class citizens, and we were contributing. I want them to know about our intellectuals, the intellectuals today that we have, but those who really set the foundation for us today. I think that's vital. I think entertainment athletes are just very minute. They may control a lot of wealth, but I tell you, they don't represent our whole culture.
Well, I think that's how they like to see us, as just entertainers, but you know, we don't get the what we deserve in terms of being.
Well, corporate America has pretty much made
scientifically.
I believe corporate America has made it pretty clear that that's how they wanted to have it. I mean, and so, but there's really truly nothing wrong with that. It's just really about assimilation, as it always has been. You know, are we going to assimilate as a culture to become stronger and to build a new bridge? You know, I believe in this day and age, it is just not enough. It's just simply not enough to be educated. It's just not enough to be trying to emulate somebody. It's really about being yourself, being bright, being aware, and really, really integrating yourself in this culture, this American culture. It's not about standing separate. It's about being American. And if you're an African American, being proud of that culture, but you have to go forth and stand on a very solid foundation, or you will be knocked off.
I agree with you there, and I want to play some of your dad's music so people are reminded. He was a Southern man. And
yes, he was.
Born in Georgia and later in Florida, but I'm going to play Georgia on My Mind on this
great choice.
Greatest hit.
Thank you.
One of his greatest hits.
Yes, it is.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you, comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Other arms reach out to me, other eyes smile tenderly, still in the peaceful dreams I see, the road leads back to you. I said, Georgia, Georgia, no peace I find, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
reach out to me. Other eyes smile tenderly. Still in peaceful dreams I see the road leads back to you. Whoa. Georgia, no peace I find, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia,
I say just an old sweet song.
That was Georgia on My Mind, and this is the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. And I am talking to Ray Charles Robinson, the son of Ray Charles. And for those that don't know, Ray Charles' last name was Robinson, correct? Not Charles.
That's correct. And the reason for that is Sugar Ray Robinson, the boxer, was very prominent. He was very successful at the time. And so he did not want to be confused with Sugar Ray Robinson, so he took the Robinson off and it became Ray Charles.
And Charles was his middle name?
Yes.
I also want to say that he was not born blind. Some people think he was, but that was not the case.
Well, I mean, as a child, my father was completely blind by age of 7. Not truly sure what caused the blindness. It may have been some form
glaucoma.
Of glaucoma. Or it could have been some kind of trauma that was caused by him watching his brother die. His brother drowned in a tub as he was 5 years old. That was pretty traumatic. And it could have been from the stress of that.
Shock.
But possibly glaucoma. He was too
poor.
His mother was too poor to have the surgery done. So at that point in time, she prepared him to go blind, and that was a pretty painful thing for him to experience by his mother being so stern. But I think you truly can see that she must have been a very wonderful woman because she did a great job with him. And so that you understand, he was basically orphaned at 7 because he was sent to the St. Augustine School for the Blind. There, he had to stay by himself. He could not even go home because they were too poor to bring him home on the train. So he had to stay in the dormitory by himself at some points when other children went home. And that's something that was not depicted in the story, in the film Ray. I talk about that in our book. And as a child, he really didn't understand why he could not come home. So, he was very angry with his mother for a long time about that. I think over time he really truly understood by others talking to him that was the only way. That school, by the age of 12, my father was a prodigy. He was playing classical music at that time. And that's something that I talk about in the book, You Don't Know Me, which was not
Was being alone the reason he was drawn to music?
He was always drawn to music by Wiley Pittman was a friend of the family, and Wiley Pittman basically nurtured his love for the piano. That's where he started to play the piano with Wiley Pittman, and once he truly had gone blind, he basically studied in the St. Augustine School for the Blind. Yes.
Well, you mentioned his mother. Was his father around, or what was the situation?
Well, Bailey Robinson, that? No, he was not. He had another wife at the time, he saw his father every now, periodically. But literally, my father was raised by two women. He was raised by Mary Jane, who was his father's wife, as well as his mother. And they both got along very well, and they both really raised him, and they both cared for him. And It's a very unique story.
Yes, it is. Your mother must have been quite a woman to befriend the wife of your father, and vice versa.
Well, it tells about her character. You know, really, it was about
her
son and him being nurtured in love. So, I mean, if it was really about love, that's something she depicted, even though she was extremely stern.
Well, I also, in your case, your father was married twice. I mean, the first marriage was very short-lived, it seemed.
Right.
But,
that's correct.
But to your mother, it went on at least close to 25 years. Tell me about your mother, Della.
Well, she is the whip. She is the foundation of our family then and now. And I truly don't believe that my father would have ever reached the height that he had risen to if it were not for her being by his side as his protector, as his wife, as somebody who really, truly, truly cared about him. And, you know, that's something that's truly depicted in the book. And I think those readers who choose to indulge the book really will understand what I'm talking about. But she was, my mother was from the South. And the first 9 chapters of the book really, truly is about her life because we did not focus on her in Ray, more so than just being his wife. And so a lot of individuals did not really, truly know about her. But she's a very strong woman, came from a very strong and solid foundation. But a country, being raised in the country. So, but my mother left home at 13. So she had a very, very rough road as a teenager. And but during this period of time, over that maybe that 10-year, 12-year stretch, she met my father, and they fell in love. And
how did they
meet?
She
was a gospel singer at the time, and he was listening to the radio, and he heard her singing, and he called into the radio station. I asked who that was, and basically he knew the choir leader, who was Cecil Shaw, and he basically proceeded to call into the show again, and my mother called him back. Well, actually, he was on the show. She called in and wanted to thank him for the kind compliment, and that's how their relationship started.
And obviously it led to marriage and 3 children.
It led to 3 children, 3 boys. I had 2 other brothers, and it led to a marriage with a lot of turmoil. Simply by, you know, my father's, his
dalliances.
On one hand, it was like this. His muse was music. That was first. That was his first love. And then, you know, there was his marriage, but then there were also, you know, his extramarital affairs. And truly, in writing this book, I really understand those affairs. I understand them somewhat. But you never truly.
Well, in the end, he had 12 children. I mean, did you meet any of the rest of them, or how does that work?
Yeah, we have met. I mean, there are a few that we have not met, but for the most part, I've met most of my brothers and sisters, at least 10.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot. Yeah, and, you know,
well, you
5 of them or 6 children were born while he was married to my mother. So, you know, as being such an icon as he was, you know, that was extremely hard for my mother, you know, the things that she had to endure with him. And I write about that because I felt that I'm a loyalist, and I felt that she was loyal to him. She was behind him, and she had his back. And I think ultimately, you know, at some point in time, he forgot about all that. And basically went out, and I think at that point in time, enough was enough.
Clearly, with his big head.
I'm sorry.
He wasn't really using his head.
Well, for whatever reason, he felt he had to do it, and this is really truly what I basically came up with. And you know, my mother was very understanding about a lot of things, but you know, my father lost his mother at a very young age. He lost Mary Jane before he was 25. So I believe, you know, that
he was always looking for love.
He was looking for love in each one of these relationships in a different way. And I truly believe that each woman represented something that he was missing out of his mother and his mother's. And I have to look at it that I look at it that way. It doesn't mean that it was right. It truly was disrespectful. But from his point of view, I think he was searching for something that he truly was missing, and he needed that nurturing, and he needed that different point of view. And that's how, and I truly believe that was one of the aspects of why he did what he did.
But don't you also think that he's away from home a lot? I mean, he's always on the road, he's traveling. He didn't take his family everywhere he went, correct?
No.
So a lot of times when you're on the road and you're a celebrity, the women are right there throwing themselves at you, and the temptation is maybe hard to resist as well.
Well, temptation's always been here. So, I mean, you know, temptation has nothing to do with it. It's really about how grounded you are, how you truly feel. Are you confident or are you insecure? Maybe he was truly insecure in a lot of ways. I believe that for my father to do the things that he did, he was insecure in a lot of ways.
Well, don't you think show business calls for that? I mean, almost every celebrity I've ever interviewed has been insecure.
Of course. That's why they need the audience. That's why they need
exactly.
the constant approval of
exactly.
what they okay? That's why they need fans. That's why they need this. You know, it's not a bad thing. It's just really how I perceive it. You
well,
know, very
they
seldom,
feed off of them.
You know,
it's
only
most,
person,
most
you know,
fans feed off of the celebrity.
Well,
it's a symbiotic relationship, I'd say.
Yeah, but then again, I don't think that's fair. I see the Bill Cosbys of the world. You know, I see I do see individuals, the Paul Newmans of the world, who basically walked away from Hollywood knowing that they can come back and do what they want to do, but their family lives were very rich. They had other things to get involved in, racing foundations, to do great things, humanitarian work. There are those who truly do love their families, and infidelity is just part of this culture, you know, too. So you can't
well,
just
I'm
look
gonna,
at them and
at
say,
at least
okay,
your mother never stopped loving him, and I want to play that I can't stop loving you, because perhaps deep down in his heart, he always loved her, and you know what I mean?
Well, I believe that.
I'm going to play that as in tribute to Mom, your mother.
I appreciate that.
Ray Charles singing, I Can't Stop Loving You, and this is for you, Della.
Made up my mind to live in memory of the lonesome time. That we once knew, though long ago, it still made me blue. They say that time heals a broken heart, but time has to steal since we've been apart.
Yeah. I can't stop loving you.
I've made up my mind to live in memory of the lonesome time.
I can't
of the lonesome time. Sing the song, children. So I'll just live my life of dreams of yesterday.
You know what you're doing. What you're going to do in China is a bit about teaching the world about black people and giving us a little justice that we so sorely need. But your father, was he also involved in the civil rights movement?
Yes, he was. Martin Luther King was a friend. And basically, you know, my father's stance was to perform, to break down the barriers in Jim Crow states. By having African Americans being able to sit in the orchestra pits, not up in the balcony. They paid the same amount of money that the Caucasians had paid, and he felt that they should have equal seating and be able to sit in front as well. And so he fought in that manner, and even though it may not be official that he was banned from the state of Georgia, he was blackballed because they would no longer promote him in those states, but Georgia, realizing their mistake, basically came back and made amends to Ray Charles and his family and the music culture as a whole by making Georgia the state song and actually issuing him an apology. Okay. And naming him
wow.
a native son of
that's
Georgia.
Great.
So I think that's a great tribute. I think it couldn't have been more befitting after his accomplishments in coming from a world of racism within
the
child very, very poor.
Yes, indeed. Now, how did that influence you in fact that most children, their parents, most children, their fathers are their fathers, famous or not, but when did you realize that your father was different from other fathers, and was it because you saw so many famous people coming in and out of your home, or did you even realize they were famous?
Well, I may have not known who they really truly were at that time, but I grew up in a house, grew up in that shadow, so to speak. You know, as a child, I grew up in that home. It was truly graced with a lot of great musicians: Blue Mitchell, Quincy Jones, Gerald Wilson, Milt Jackson. A lot of these great musicians constantly would come through the home. I would see Muhammad Ali, but come to the home several times. But during this period of time, I knew his music was great. You know, I knew that as a child. But I didn't know the significance of it all until I became a teenager and an adult. And so, you know, I was truly graced by that experience.
Well, what was your father like as a father? Are there any special moments that the two of you share as father and son that imprinted in your mind?
Well, you know, I was pretty close to him, you know. We were entwined in a different way than most kids are with their fathers. You know, I found my father bleeding to death. He accidentally cut himself on the edge of his desk in his office one night. Unfortunately, he was under influence of heroin, so he didn't really truly know that he had cut himself. And so this night, you know, I asked my mother, you know, can I go kiss Dad goodnight? And my mother said, no, you know, I just need you to go to bed. You know, I'll tell your daddy you love him and go to bed. So that's what we did, and as I lie there thinking about it, I hear just bumping around in his office, and, you know, my father always did that all night, playing music and constantly working. But this night he was just, you know, it was just a lot of bumping around. So I got out of bed, and as I, eased down the hallway, and I basically knocked at the door several times, and, you know, there was no response. And so as children do, you know, I opened the door, and there he was, and, you know, blood was, he had a white shirt on that night, and his shirt was soaked with blood. Blood was all over the wall, and I basically found him, and if I had not gone there that night, he would have died. He would have bled to death. I believe we were intertwined that way. That truly made our relationship special. But also, you know, as a teenager, when he basically really tried to bond with me, basically that was through music and basically the experience of sharing the music with me. And I happen to tell you that was a great experience that I don't believe that anyone knows except those who sat in that studio with him and, you know, basically almost in the dark, watching him splice tape himself, watching him operate his board, watching himself punch himself in to do his vocals, watching him equalize, watching him edit all the music and then basically critique it again, make it perfect, and that process of perfection that he sought in his music. I believe that was very special, you know. I believe that was the only way that was the only world that he could control. And so that was the world that he brought me into, basically, to have a relationship with him. And so I believe it was special.
Well, I want to ask you about a little bit, if you don't mind, about how did he get involved in drugs, and why did you, seeing how it affected him?
I'm not really sure. You know, I believe, you know, my father just, you know, there was a lot of heartache. There was just a lot of heartache, and I believe at such a young age, being around the musicians in which he was, and he was younger, I believe that was the thing to do, he felt. And I also felt that, you know, maybe he wanted to live outside of himself, you know, his mind just being in total darkness. And I couldn't imagine living inside my head 24/7. Not being able to avoid the pictures of his mother and those who he loved, who have basically passed away, his brother who he saw drown. I believe these things were always constantly with him. And so I kind of understand where he wanted to maybe zone out or not have to think about that. And I believe that the influence of heroin and watching other musicians basically influenced his use. And he followed suit in that. Me,
well,
my girls... I mean, I knew the perils of drugs. You know, I saved my father when he was under the influence of heroin. And but I do not blame my father. I do not think it was a gene. I believe that I went against all my moral principles. And for those who are listening and those who have teenage kids or young adults, I knew the perils of drugs. I didn't use drugs until I was 18 or 19 years old. After I graduated from high school, you know, I tried it. I did not like it. And basically my mother always basically stressed the importance of that. And I stayed away from that. It wasn't until
I
wanted to fit in. And basically trying to fit in, knowing the perils and knowing that this is not something that you wake up with. It is something that you do, and it's something that will alter your natural being. I did it. And when I did do it, and I ventured into an area I had no experience in, that was I was knee-deep in something I had no idea how to deal with. And ultimately, by the time you start dealing with it, then it becomes a part of your being. It becomes a part of your, you know, your social being. And next thing you know, you have an addiction.
Well, he was on hard drugs. Did you start off that way or just soft drugs like marijuana or something?
No, I didn't like marijuana. I just basically, I tried cocaine, you know. I started doing it with my friends and at parties on the weekend and so on and so forth. And that escalated into, you know, smoking it. And that was basically being introduced to a whole new group of individuals that were partying, and I was in college at the time, and I just believe that, you know, I believe I was living such a straight life, such a very extremely ordinary. I was always conscious of, you know, the things that I did, and I basically wanted to do something on my own, and that just truly wasn't it. I was an athlete. It went against all my moral being, and basically when you do that, you're making a big mistake. You can never go against yourself, your moral fiber, and the ethics and the morals in which your parents have bestowed on you. And if you do that, you will lose. It's very simple.
Now that's an interesting lesson.
That is a lesson for...
And I hope people hear that, because that is so true.
You never, ever, ever test your moral fiber. You never go against yourself. You're defeating yourself first. You're defeating God, who is there to protect you, number one. You hurt him first before you hurt yourself, because it is his hedge of protection. Then you hurt yourself. And then that grows exponentially. Then those around you, my children, suffer from that, just as I suffered from it. I brought it into their world, as my father brought it into me. So it's behavioral, and I think that's more important for parents to really understand that your behavior can influence your children. They don't have to smoke cigarettes or anything. Your behavior is what they see and what they do, and what you do and do what you say and mean what you say is very vital. You can't tell you can't expect your kids to be anything other than what the energy in which you put into them. But
well,
the decision to go
I found a
yourself,
song that your father wrote, and I never heard it before. It's called "Let's Go Get Stoned."
Well, that was written by Ashford and Simpson, I think, and that was pretty bold for him to write about that. But I believe at the time, as most individuals who have substance abuse, he didn't realize what it was. He had an idea that it was affecting his life, but, you know, he felt he was in control. And that's why I write about it, because he was totally out of control at that time. He couldn't see himself. And even if he had eyesight, if you're in denial about your substance abuse issues, okay, whether it's drinking, whether it's eating, or whatever the case may be, if you're in denial, you cannot see yourself. And
so I want to play that, and then I want to come back and ask you how both of you eventually got off drugs, because both of you did, correct?
That's correct.
All right, I'm going to play that now when Ray Charles wrote, "Let's Go Get Stoned."
Fantastic.
Not wrote. Thanks.
Let's go get stoned.
Yeah.
Let's go get stoned.
Everybody. Wait a minute. You know my baby, she won't let me in. I've got a few pennies. I'm gonna buy myself a bottle of gin, and then I'm gonna call my buddy on the telephone and say, so hard all day long. Everything I try to do seems to always turn out wrong. That's why I want to stop by on my way home and say, now let me tell you one more thing. Have a little taste, but don't lose your cool and start messing up the man's place. Ain't no harm. Take a little nip, but don't you fall down and bust your lip. No, no.
Everybody
wants to come on and go with me.
So what was the turning point for both of you?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
What was the turning point for both of you that made you decide enough of this, no more drugs?
Oh, I think that you have to see your life before you, you know. And once you're able to see your life, you hope to see yourself. If you can see yourself, that's vital. And by seeing yourself, you're able to see that that is not who you are, you know, and what you do is not necessarily who you are, but the perception is that is who you are. And so if that's the way you want, if there's a change to be made, it has to be changed. It has to be done for you. It cannot be done for your children. It cannot be done for your wife. It cannot be done for your friends. You have to decide that you feel that you need to treat yourself much better than that, that you owe yourself more than that. And furthermore, our lives aren't ours to ruin, you know. I mean, God gave us a vessel, and, you know, a healthy vessel, and we're constantly trying to break that down. And so when you truly really understand that, and you truly have experienced individuals who have passed away under less dire situations, you know, you're truly taking your life for granted. Once I realized I was taking my life for granted, once I realized that what I was doing was illegal, number one, I had to stop. I mean, and can you imagine that, doing that maybe for 12 years or in and out of an issue like that? And then you totally realize that what you're doing is illegal.
Well, your father even went to jail once or twice for that, right? Or I remember they arrested him at one point.
Yeah, my father went to jail several times, and you know, during the course of his lifetime, I was arrested once. But mine was more like it turned out to be an intervention from my ex-wife, basically.
But was that a way to? That's scary.
Well, she basically did it because, you know, they basically felt, you know. You know, it was easy for me to isolate. It's easy for somebody to isolate if they have money. It's easy for you to shut yourself off and insecure yourself so that you cannot. So somebody has to intervene at some time. But in retrospect, it wasn't about her intervening with that arrest, because basically I didn't have to go the route I had to go and just walk out of court. And I believe it was a life-changing situation when I decided to basically go into a program. I wanted to try something different. And in that program, basically, I was basically able to see myself. I was able to understand my behavior, and I was able to really track my behavior. And then I think the ultimate lesson I learned is that stop blaming people. What was your participation in where you are? And if you can take a look at yourself and say, you know what, if it wasn't for me doing this, I wouldn't be in this position, you know, I think you would get over a lot of your mistakes very quickly.
So it's about taking responsibility in the end, right?
It's about taking responsibility for your life and your actions. And basically, if your actions, you go and take care of that and move on with your life and basically become an example. But you also become an example to yourself, which you have to rebuild your life, your reputation, and to rebuild trust amongst your peers and your business associates. So it's really about going forward in a positive manner and basically putting there are no crutches in life. And basically you have to deal with life on life's terms, okay, without having it tainted from something else. Yeah, that's why they call it drugs.
Why did you do? Well, I know why you did it, but how did you feel doing not only a book about your father and your family, but also a film, Ray, and you've done other films too. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, I love film, and film is something I actually fell into because I basically was trained in the financial industry. I basically, when I got out of college, I went to work for New York Life and Money Financial. So I was in the financial arena, and I was getting ready to trade stocks and bonds, okay? And become a trader, and then I basically went into marketing, entertainment marketing, and film and television production. And so I actually bumped into it, and I felt that there was a grand opportunity to basically represent my father in several different projects in which they were not doing. I wanted to find a loophole in which he was not doing and capitalizing on, and basically go and basically try to give him more exposure by doing media work. And that's what I did. And being a co-producer, it took us 14 years to make Ray.
Wow.
I bought the rights from my father in 1988, okay, to do Ray. And we did not end up making this film until 2003, okay, and it wasn't viewed by the public until 2004. So that's what I call commitment, persistence, and but that's what it takes in this industry. But I feel that from a producing standpoint, if you really want to truly be a part of how the public views you and talk about your culture in a positive manner, then you have to be a part of the solution, and that is being a producer and being able to bring your lives to the screen to where others can experience that.
Were you happy the way Jamie Foxx portrayed your father?
Jamie Foxx was simply brilliant. I think he was the perfect actor. It was the perfect screenplay. We had the perfect production team with Phil Anschutz, the executive producer of with Crusader Entertainment. His performance was second to none, and I don't think you really have to really appreciate his performance, because being on the set, Jamie had to walk around with the prosthetic on his eyes all day, probably 12 hours a day, and that was pretty tough. And he did that for 40 days, okay, almost 50 days. That's you know, he came prepared.
That challenges you as an actor.
Pardon me?
That challenges you as an actor.
Well, I think it challenged him simply because he had a chance to basically bridge a gap between generations, but also I don't think he even really approached the role from this standpoint. It really just wasn't about his study of my father and his movements, but you know, he stepped into the spirit of Ray Charles. And that's why people were able to feel that movie. That's why it is the best biopic ever made, okay? Financially, from gross receipts to the performances and the Academy Awards which were won by the production of that film.
He deserved every one of them, because I saw it. It was a beautiful, beautiful film.
He did a fantastic job, and I still don't think people really understand the magnitude of what he had to do. There was a lot of pressure on him. I was sitting on set every day until I left to make another film. That was pressure. Ray Charles was alive, and how can you take on the responsibility of portraying an individual who is still alive, and just think if you ruin that, right? The onus falls on him. So he came prepared, and he looked like he came prepared in his performance, and that's all you. I think enough is said. It was a job well done. And
did your father come on the set?
No, my mother did not come on the set. No.
Your father?
Pardon me?
You said your father.
Yeah, my father,
your father
was on the set in Los Angeles when the production came back to Los Angeles. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
And tell me about the book. You Don't Know Me: Reflections of My Father, Ray Charles. This was, of course, written after he passed.
Yeah, this is written after his past. Basically, I wanted to tell a unique story about his relationship with my mother, about what my mother went through, and about my mother's life, as well as, you know, I wanted to chronologize my life for my grandchildren and my children. And through writing this book, my children were able to learn more about their grandfather and their grandmother. And so were my grandchildren once they're able to read the book. And then I really truly wanted it to be inspiring about overcoming obstacles and struggles in your life, and which money has nothing to do with. You know, you can have all the money in the world, but you cannot buy your happiness. You cannot buy sobriety. You cannot buy all the God-given things that were given to us for free, and we basically took those for granted, and we had to fight our way back into Main Street, to mainstream America, or your mainstream of your life, in order to enjoy that, you know, and in overcoming, I guess, it's easy to be somebody who's never faced challenges, who's never had to deal with that, and say, okay, I had a successful life, but what about being able to say at the end of my life, you know, everything that I did worked for the better for me to build the foundation that I stand upon today, and I believe that we're just as strong, or may even be stronger than those individuals. And so I believe that everything I went through is for a reason. And ultimately, my story and my father's story is going to help inspire someone else.
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to play You Don't Know Me.
Well, that's a great choice.
Here we go.
My heart is beating slow, and anyone can tell you think you know me well, but you don't know me.
No, you don't know me.
No, you don't know the one who dreams of you at night and longs to kiss your lips and longs to hold you tight. That's all I've ever been, 'cause you don't know me.
No, you don't know me.
For I never knew the art of making love, though my heart aches with love for you. Afraid let my chance go by, a chance that you might love me too.
Love me too.
You give your hand to me, and then you say goodbye. I watch you walk away, beside the lucky guy. Oh, to never, never know the one who loves you so well. You don't know me.
For I never knew the art of making love, for my heart aches with love for you.
Afraid and shy, I let my chance go by, a chance that you might. I watch you walk away beside the lucky guy. Oh, you never, never know the one who loves you so well. You don't know me.
You don't love me. You don't know.
I'm going to ask you, when and how did your dad die?
My dad passed away in June 10th, 2004. And he passed away from liver disease.
The liver disease?
Cancer of the liver, yes.
And when you think about your time with your father, what did he leave you? What part of him is still with you and will always be with you?
Now the music. Yeah, we always live inside the music, you know. That's That's where, you know, all your dreams, you know, all your thoughts, you know, can abound in, you know. And there's nobody to blame, you know, in the end, you know. And in living inside the music, you know, life with him was still as beautiful as a dream.
I guess that's my question to you. What I was really asking you is, you love yourself, besides your music. You
I'm
love
sorry.
Your dad, and besides the music, you love your father, and what of him is in you? What do you feel? Because you yourself are not a singer, but I understand your daughter is.
Yeah, my daughter BR is. She goes by BR, and she's, you know, she's grinding right now, you know, trying to find her niche, and but she does sing. She has a beautiful voice, and she's getting close, very close. But what he left with me, I mean, is that that burning desire to be independent, to be and to build something from nothing, and you know, and I'm doing that with the Foundation for America.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, Foundation for America is really, it's about transforming lives, and basically, you know, we want to be able to transform lives. We aspire to, as well as build, you know, more vibrant and sustainable communities, whether that's through affordable housing or however we begin to approach that. But, you know, there are a lot of foundations out here trying to do a lot of different things with this, they're doing the same old things, expecting different results. We're virtually looking for innovative ideas, basically committing ourselves to creative, positive, and lasting results in implementing innovative solutions to critical social issues, whether that's in the African-American community or if it's in an economically challenged community in America.
And right now, America is very economically challenged.
I'm sorry, America is economically challenged, and once again, it is extremely vital for us, you know, to address not only that, but the homeless situation and education. I believe a lot of money, I believe a lot of solutions, there are a lot of great solutions and foundations around the country today. I simply believe that, once again, you know, those who live in economically challenged communities are at the bottom of the totem pole again. So it's going to take the philanthropic resolve of public charities and private charities and foundations like myself to be able to come, to be able to offer not only just a home and be able to help them gain the confidence within themselves, but we have to show them how, retrain them in job skills, being able to help them as first-time home buyers, being able to provide them in an environment, giving them the skills to be sustainable. And if they are sustainable, that becomes, and that grows exponentially. You know, teenage pregnancy and welfare perpetuates poverty.
Exactly.
And I believe that system wasn't, whether it was invented for that purpose or not, it is not one where someone has the opportunity to grow. They get settled in that position. And I'm here to tell them that that is not the way. And if you continue in that manner, your behavior, not only will you not be able to be a part of this American culture, you will be counting on this culture to give you something in order to live. And that is not living. That is existing.
Exactly. I agree with you so much.
And that is being perpetuated in our culture. And, I do not intend
to
sit around and look
mindset,
at it and be
a
service.
Change of mind.
Pardon me?
I think this society needs a complete rehabilitation itself, a change of mindset and thinking,
well,
how we are as a culture.
You cannot change adults. You can only change adults by sustainable, provable, and measurable results. And so you have to, you know, there have to be more foundations that are being vocal and to get resolved. You can't just throw money at an issue. You can't do that.
I agree.
And so, you know, you have to be vocal. And so I just spoke to a group of individuals about teen pregnancy and how we spend $9 billion just on teen pregnancy. And if a teenager before 20 years old, we have, what, 1 million children being born to teenage mothers. Well, if you look at that, that's breeding poverty. those children, 90 out of 100 will not graduate from school. Their children become children of impoverished mothers and fathers, okay, who in turn will turn their children into that, and they will follow in their footsteps. That's a $9 billion issue, okay? And so somebody's not doing a great job of, you know, it's not just about
changing that around.
It's not just not about that. It is the United States leads everyone in the Western world in teenage pregnancy. So some of these organizations
why
are
do you think
working,
that is?
And I'm not going
to
go into
political
names or anything
system.
Like that. But you know, you can draw, you can read between the lines. If it's a $9 billion a year job, that means that ultimately these people are going to become our children, and anybody who lives in poverty who is on the welfare system, you might as well say they're part of your family because you're paying for it.
Exactly.
So either you can pay to help them rehabilitate themselves and put them in a position where they have no choice, okay, or you can continue to perpetuate poverty and let it be a tool, let it be a means for somebody, ends for somebody's means.
Well, whether it's deliberate or not, it's not helping the society. It's in the end, it drains the society, so nobody benefits, so it makes no sense to allow it to keep perpetuating.
African Americans need to wake up because mm-hmm. basically there's a group of individuals that aren't even, they're living below poverty, and that means that they're not a part of, they're existing. They're not a part of this productive fabric of America. You know, I don't care whether it is going to work for McDonald's. You know, you go, that's corporate America. You go there, you do your job, you understand what that job is. What's from keeping you from being a manager? What is wrong with that? Okay? It's not about selling drugs. It's not about playing basketball and all these things. It's about education. And the education that you do get, strive to get a scholarship to further your education. Without that, you do not have a chance. Not a chance.
I agree. Sadly to say, I want to ask you one more question, or maybe two.
Yes.
What do you want your readers to walk away from after reading the book, your book?
Oh, I lived a life second to none, number one. I believe that my father was, I believe that when they truly read the book and they really see what he had to overcome in his personal life, you know, besides, you know, just because of, you know, women and the other things that he did, sometimes you do things that's not who you are. I want them to be able to see who he truly was and what he had to overcome in order to be the great man that he was. My father was a great, whether we had a bittersweet relationship, it has nothing to do with it. I respect him. I loved him as my father. And I wouldn't be here to be able to talk to you about anything if it wasn't for him. But I also want them to be able to look at his accomplishments in a totally new, different way. And I believe that once they really truly see the depth in which he had to go in order to overcome to be the great Ray Charles that that Americans know, I think that they will walk away with a sense of inspiration. They will walk away with inspiration truly in reading my story and being candid about it. I believe it's very easy for individuals to write about their successes, but I write about my failures in life so that there's more emphasis on that in which I do.
Don't you think that it's experiences, all those experiences accumulate and become culminating in who you are, what you become? I think they're all necessary and important.
But if I can help somebody not go down that road, and my father writes about that, and I think there's a great song which I feel he was talking to me in the song because it fits perfectly. It's called If I Could. And basically he talks about all the things that he wishes that he could have done or as a father or any father can do for his child. And I hope the listeners go and listen to that song, and I think they'll really truly feel the importance of why I wrote this book. And, you know, it wasn't easy growing up as his son.
Sure.
It wasn't easy growing up to a father who did not know how to be a father. And it didn't matter how much or how wealthy he was. But I also want individuals to know that my father did not wear shoes until he was age 7. And he left an estate in well excess of $70 million. And so there is no excuse, and there is no one, regardless of your race, color, or creed, that can hold you back if you truly believe in yourself. And if you believe in yourself and you're true to yourself, you can accomplish a lot in this life.
And we can end the show on that statement. But I also want to know, where can the listeners get your book?
They can go to RachelJr.com.
Okay.
There you have a different array of bookstores in which you can purchase the book online through my website. And if they want to know more about my foundation, they can go to Ray Charles Jr. Foundation for America, .com, or .org, I mean. And that website will be up probably within the next week. And, you know, that's it. You know, I truly appreciate this opportunity to talk about my life and my father's life.
And it's been a wonderful show and very interesting, and I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing that with us. And for those that are listening, again, you can go to, is it raycharles.org?
You can go to raycharlesjr.com. And if they want to know more about my foundation, the Ray Charles Jr. Foundation for America, they can go to that, Ray Charles Jr. Foundation for America.org. Okay.
Okay, you heard that, folks. And again, I want to thank you, Ms. Robinson, for coming on the show today and sharing your life and that of your father's.
Pleasure. It's a pleasure, and I hope that the book is inspiring. I hope that what I do and I hope that what I do, I just hope to be a catalyst in through my foundation, and I hope that my work continues to inspire and empower.
Well, we know you're going to be going to China, and are there other projects on the agenda besides China and your foundation? Another film, or?
At some point, I'm working on another. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to write next. There is a development project with my foundation at some point, which we will announce at some point at the latter part of this year. In my personal life, I mean, it's really truly about doing more film, and I'm working on doing that as an executive producer. Yes.
Well, we look forward to this, to all your projects in the future. Now that
truly
we know
appreciate
who you
the
are.
Opportunity for me to talk with you today.
It's been great. I really would like to follow up on your foundation because it sounds vital and very important, and I really ask the listeners today to look into that because what he's doing is vital, and we do need to look at ourselves and educate ourselves and change our positions and situations in life.
It is vital for our culture.
It is. Vital. Totally vital for our culture.
It is.
And I'm Deirdre Shuler, the host of the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Soul. And I want to thank my listeners for listening to my show with Ray Charles Robinson Jr. today and for making my topic to yours. And you know what? We're going to end the show with I Had My Fun by Ray Charles.
Tell her. don't send no doctor. Doctor can't do no good. Tell her don't send no doctor. Doctor can't do no good. Mother, please don't worry. This is all in my prayer. Mother, please don't worry. This is all in my prayer. Just say your son is gone out of this world somewhere.
Wake on summer, head on the fall. Had to take my Christmas in overalls. Now she's gone, and I don't worry. I'm sitting on top of the world. When I had you, baby, you wouldn't treat me right. You stayed away both day and night. Now she's gone, and I don't worry. I'm sitting on top of the world. Sitting on top of the world.